Folks, this is Radio Ayahuasca with me, Zart. It's the radio show from the forums at ayahuasca.com. It's great to be back. You just heard Ian Brown with Time Is My Everything, and particularly relevant because there's been a huge gap between this show and the previous ones. It seemed to go onto hiatus and nobody knew why, me least of all. I've no idea where the time went, but we're back as usual right now. This time round, it's Radio Ayahuasca 16. We've got Peter Gorman dropping in to give us what I think are exclusive readings from his new book. Peter G, if you don't know who that is, please check out Radio Ayahuasca 10 and 11 on the blog. More great stuff in from the forum. We've got contributions from our resident poet Larry Lazaffa and Silly Boy throwing a few of his word shapes our way. I want to remind you that you're listening to Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at yahe.net/9000. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spfradio.yahe.net for playlists, archives, and more. As always, thanks to Raymond, the hidden hand at SPF Radio, for keeping this whole thing together. Let's get on with it.
The divine is in the mud on your shoes, the wrinkle in your skin, the doubt, the mistakes. We come from the other side of forever, and we are exactly where God wants us. Have you not ever known this in your soul? Have you not ever sensed this in your touch? Have you not ever heard this in your heart? When you say, I love you, and felt the strength of God, the face of God, the hands of God within you in a kiss of your beloved. The one that brings you light, gives you sight, shares with you the night, and takes you to the other side of forever. I walked down to the pond to gather feathers and found one. So the next time I went to the pond to find a feather, I found many. I questioned my connection, my inspiration, and a leaf falls at my feet. Then I heard a dove call and woo the who in my heart. I give to you my words, my love. In return, you occupy me with wonder, sometimes thunder, like the water that burns. Would you want to leave heaven or stay sane in hell, to mend with the spirit, to tend the sacred flame, to send light into the night? This tree that lives within me shares with you a leaf of peace. This pond of poetry I seek has feathers of belief. Like the geese and moon, you guide me and give me sight through my madness, the darkness, and into the light. She beams through my dreams, this time in a state of mind, seeking to find this time tomorrow. Today I awaken from my slumber, and I wonder, does the spirit blunder? The want of the day, the gifts of the night. Each time I know, I must let go. I am taught not to connect the dots, to wait and not speculate. There's a thread of the spirit in the mundane. There's a thread of the mundane with the spirit, like yin and yang. The imperfection makes it perfect, makes it real, gives it life. I've grown old, fat, and lazy. My burden is being crazy. It's a chore to stay sane. Madness is a monster that guards a door to the treasures of the soul, like peace and kindness. The kind have always inherited the earth. Those that don't know peace don't know its worth. There is no need to argue or fight. These words are true, are light only to me. There is no need to impose your halo. My life is blessed, blessed with strife. My heaven is here on the road when I return home. Pardon the delay, I'm under construction. To return to the process of essence, a hum. The thing I love most about you is you always want to improve. Somehow I knew through the midnight blue I could come back from smoke and ash. Your perfection of faith and fate, my mistake. And there you are again, up in the sky, perfectly timed. Thank you too for the rescue. To return to this poetry, this love, this light, my piece of the puzzle of life.
Sheep's in the meadow, the cow's in the corn. Now is the time for a child to be born. He'll cry at the moon and he'll laugh at the sun. If he's a boy, he'll carry a gun, sang the crow on the cradle. If it should be that our baby's a girl, never you mind if her hair doesn't curl. Rings on her fingers, bells on her toes, a bomber above her crow on the cradle. Rock-a-bye, baby, the dark and the light. Somebody's baby is born for a fight. Rock-a-bye, baby, the white and the black. Somebody's baby is not coming back, sang the crow on the cradle. Your mother and father, they'll scrape and they'll save, build you a coffin and dig you a grave. Hush-a-bye, little one, why do you weep? We have a toy that will put you to sleep, sang the crow on the cradle. Shoot that bird dead. That's what your father and mother once said. Crow on the cradle, what shall I do? That is the thing I leave up to you, sang the crow on the cradle.
The wind is as warm as ecstasy itself. When it blows, the body melts. Oh, that feels so good. Ah, yes. Feeling blessed and feeling blessed. Not another soul in sight. Insight. This whole place is in soul. This whole place is alive. This whole place is as high as I right now. This dried grass is purposefully woven into an inexplicable Celtic carpet from which emerge grey splunking heathers turning purpler towards the distance. Close up, grey like coral in the sun's rays. Oh, that wind is as warm as ecstasy itself. When it blows on my body melts. I am one with this ground. My breath is the wind that runs across this land. My beard is akin to the forest, which weirdly rises contains so very many surprises. Not just morsels of dropped food. Oh no. Sacred grottos and sparkling streams and little bits of dropped food and monkeys' dreams and birds singing songs in alien languages that not even aliens can understand. Because all there is to be understood is the vague notion that it's all good. It's all good, like the yellow gauze, spiky like a barred door, but welcoming to the little feathered people who pluck the little pointy-legged people from their nets. When times are hard and snow is dressed, they're outsides in fuzzy houses that nonetheless insulate. Insulator. Peep to you too, you blessed little ruffler of breast feathers. Ooh, pick a nut, you beautiful little black-capped tit with your white cheeks, cheeky. It's me who's cheeky. I've got this strange mouth that can't stop speaking. And again, this land is a king, and each tree a spike in its crown. Blessed be.
This is Radio Waska.
I'm Peter Gorman. I'm a journalist. And I always had a great streak of wanderlust. And I hitchhiked nearly 50,000 miles in the United States and Canada during college years and shortly after that. And then I finally made my way down to the jungles of Mexico. The woman I lived with at the time was very concerned, caring, wonderful, great lady. Well, it turned out that she said, now that he loves the jungle, I know he's going to want to go to the Amazon. So she scoured the Strand bookstore to find the scariest story she could find on the Amazon, one that would make me not want to go there. It was a book by a man named Updegraff, I don't know his first name, and it was called Headhunters of the Amazon. He was a fellow who went to school in upstate New York and had a classmate at the turn of the century whose father dealt with gold in Ecuador. I mean, it was an Ecuadorian friend. And so one summer, Updegraff joined his Ecuadorian friend, and there was an indigenous uprising against the father, which set our lad off into the jungles of Ecuador and finally into Peru. And he ended up spending about 4 years trying to get out of the jungles, but they were four fascinating years on the Rio Yavarí. And rather than turning me off, the book made me want to see the Yavarí and spend time on the Yavarí. That's between Brazil and Peru. And the jump-off point for that, in terms of getting there by an aeroplane, was Iquitos. So that's how I ended up in the Amazon to begin with. I decided I needed to go to Iquitos. And I went with a couple of friends, and we traveled to where they wanted to go in Peru, which was largely mountains at extremely high altitudes, and cigarette-smoking me, who was having a, like, decent, but not the best time in the life, until we hit Peru. And when we hit Peru, I mean, when we hit Iquitos, we ran into a little guide who said, do you want to go out to see the jungle? I'd had enough of guides, didn't want anything to do with them, and said no. So my friends and I simply took a boat up the river to a place that turned out to be called Ricana. We didn't know where we were going, just got on one of the big river boats, landed there, and then looked for a guide. And it turned out there were none. Everyone was terrified of going into the jungle. Under the canopy, they would go, half a day's walk maybe to hunt, and then be able to walk out in the other half a day. When we arrived back in Iquitos 10 days later, there was this little old man saying, now do you want to go see the jungle? Because I know wherever you were, nobody would actually take you under that canopy. They're too afraid of demons and jaguars and Indians. And so I relented and said, okay. And the story's longer than that, but we ended up going out for 3 days with him. And one of the things he did was take us to an old curandero who made this strange brew, ayahuasca. We knew nothing about it. I'd never heard of it. I didn't know anybody. This is pre-internet days. 1984, in Iquitos, wasn't being visited very much. The McKennas had only gotten there in 1983, which Dennis continues to rub my nose in, but still a year ahead of me. And so it wasn't as though there were, you know, Burroughs and Ginsberg had written the Yahe letters. There were some obscure mentions, you know, in books, but at that time, again, pre-internet, you'd really have to go find those books. So we ended up doing the ayahuasca, and for me, it was a very life-changing experience, not just the ayahuasca, but spending time in the jungle and spending time with my friend Moises towards Vienna. And it became kind of an obsession that I come back and spend time out in the jungle. And one of the things that helped put the jungle in my blood, is how Moises would put it, was ayahuasca. So unbeknownst to me and without intending anything, I became a student of an old fellow named Julio Herrera. He became a teacher, and as it became clear that I was a student, I became sort of a reluctant student because the demand on me got pretty heavy. So somehow 25 years passed, during which time I collected for the American Museum of Natural History from down there. I collected botanical specimens for Shaman Pharmaceuticals, herpetological specimens for Ophidia Research Center of Rome, and also for the American Museum of Natural History, and finally even some fossils. So while my trips always had different purposes to them, ayahuasca was an element in them. And at some point people just said, Peter, you've written these long pieces about ayahuasca. Why don't you put a front end on it, you know, write the last 5 years' worth of experiences, and clean them all up and put them together, and you'll have a book. And so that's how a journalist like me, who generally writes a story at a time, wound up writing a very, very long story, which is just a 250-page book. But for a journalist, that seems like an awful long story.
Right. And first of all, thanks, Peter, for coming back on this show. Peter Gorman, folks, friend of the Radio Ask program, here to give us the first in a series of readings from his new book. Now, we both know what the book's about. Peter, you've done a great job explaining who the heck you are and how you got here. What is the full title of the book?
The full title of the book is Ayahuasca in My Blood, 25 Years of Medicine Dreaming. It's 250 pages. It's available on BarnesandNoble.com. Amazon.com is the one that's really been selling it pretty well. On Lulu, a Kindle edition comes out this week. Uh-huh. The hardcover edition just came out. Sony is going to have an edition soon. Go out and buy it. Don't listen to this podcast. Ignore this entirely. I'm going to read it in a botched up way so you guys will all go out and buy it. All right, just kidding. By all means, listen to it and enjoy it. I hope I can read it.
Well, before you do get started, Peter, let's have a little bit on how the book came to be. Now, anyone who's heard your background might think it was just a case of putting pen to paper, but I'm guessing at some point you were not writing a book, and then later on you were considering writing a book, and here we are now, you have written a book. So if you could talk us through some of that, please, on how the book came to be the book.
This is going to be really arrogant, but it's true. I'd been a former editor-in-chief of High Times magazine. Early on, I'd written stories about the Amazon and India and Morocco and even New York crack, when the crack epidemic first broke. I'd written for Playboy, Penthouse, Geo, World Magazine, which was very big in England at the time, Geographical, which was big in England 20 years ago. I had written for the world's biggest magazines, and I thought that somebody would come knocking on my door and say, well, here's $50,000. Let's take these ayahuasca stories you've done and you know, fashion a book and give us X number of new pages. And, you know, it never happened. Just never. I couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it. And now, since I've published it myself, two companies have come and asked me, pull it from the shelves and we'll publish it for you. And we'll call it a new edition and we'll give it a new cover. And I said, I can't give it a new cover. And I can't, you know, I finally got reviews coming out in all sorts of pretty cool places for this type of book. And I think more on the way. And it's actually selling. It's only been out for, you know, 2 months. And nobody knows it's out. It's only out on Amazon and Lulu and Amazon UK. So, you know, unless people know me or know someone who's read the book, they're not going to, you know, so far that circle is not gotten past that. Hopefully it will. So, yes, I considered writing the book, but I always was waiting for someone to give me a bunch of money to do it. I was raising a family. I had to support kids. I had a very large extended family in Peru that needed taken care of. And, you know, as somebody at the time who was working as editor-in-chief of High Times magazine, pretty high-profile editor position, you know, I was never going to take the time to put it together. You know, myself, just for myself. I just thought, it's just vanity press. And then, here's the twist. About 3 years ago, a former client on one of my trips to Peru, to the Amazon, Johann Freeman, suddenly sent me what looked like a PDF of a finished book. He had gone ahead and designed a book, made up a table of contents, and used the stories that I had previously published in their own state, with a nice cover to say, Peter, isn't it time you turn this into a book? And that began this darn, that's really, you know, that pushed me over the edge. If somebody thought it was important enough to do that and spend hours, I don't know how many hours. So he designed the most beautiful book in the world, and he even insisted on me contacting the Escher Foundation and buying the rights to use an Escher print on the cover, print of snakes. It's pretty. And then another former client, Morgan Marr, and I were talking about something one day, and I mentioned the book, and he said he'd love to do some illustrations for it. And so suddenly, he's sending down illustrations on the internet, and they were gorgeous. And I just was like, okay, I guess I've got to do this. And it took about 8 months to really do it. I mean, I had to write, take the other stories, edit them all out, you know, see where they fit together, put in all sorts of new stories to make even the ones that are previously published work, write, well, two or three brand new sections of the book, and then pay four different editors to go over it, and, you know, one specialized in Spanish, so to make sure my accents were in the right place, and one was just a great editor who hates ayahuasca, hates this aspect of my life, but loves my other writing, and tore it to pieces. So one by one, you know, I let those people have a big hand in making it something that I think the Gorman Bench Press, which is officially the company that built it, that book or published that book, it was a bench press because it was a big weight off my chest. Gorman Bench Press put out a really, really high-class product, I think.
Me too. Now, one final diversion before we get going. It was back in Radio Asker 10 when we last spoke to you, Peter. Is there anything you want to update us on since then? Any news about the Gorman Jungle Jaunts, that kind of thing?
Well, as a matter of fact, this January 11, I've got two. I've got a 21-day trip. And in early February, I've got a nine-and-a-half-day jungle intensive. The first trip includes the jungle intensive. And then we go on, we have a couple of days to do some extra things. So we do 12 days in Iquitos in the jungle, and then we head up to Cusco and Machu Picchu, where people will get a chance to utilize San Pedro and be part of a Pachamama ceremony. And they'll get to use San Pedro with the best two healers I know, just a fellow named Cucho and my teacher, Don Victor. Just amazing, amazing people to be with. In the jungle, they're going to have the regular jungle trip, which changes every time, so regular doesn't really count. But just an amazing time being able to utilize the Matsez medicine, Sapo and Nunu, being able to use some local magic-grown fungi on the boat, the overnight boat trip up the river. And that's one of the ceremonies I hold, and I think that's a fun one, to watch the Amazon River underneath you and the Amazon sky above your head, and watch a boat get loaded and unloaded on one of the only nights in your life you're ever going to spend on a river boat in the Amazon. And the little sisters just give you a little extra push to stay awake and see things in all their glorious color, as well as to, you know, utilize ayahuasca. Just plant collecting or swamp walking. Anyway, it's gorgeous. So, yeah, there's two trips. And you can reach me at pgorman.com or, I'm sorry, peterg9 at yahoo.com. They're not inexpensive. They cost a bunch of money. I pay an awful lot of people, and we do a lot of very, very excellent things. I do not take people out to a lodge, sit them down, and have them stay there for a week. That's not the purpose of my trips. My trips are really an introduction to the Northwest Amazon, her plants, peoples, and culture. So in the same way that ayahuasca was brought to me as part of the culture I was learning about, I introduce people to the ayahuasca as part of the cultural experience, not exclusive of that.
Nice touch, Peter. Okay, let's do it. Peter Gorman, how would you like to start?
I'm going to start at the beginning of the book. I'm going to skip the acknowledgments, and I put a glossary in the front end of the book rather than the back. I put a glossary in because I thought it was important for people who don't know ayahuasca, have never been to ceremony, little things like what's a shaman, what's sopla mean, if the word sopla is used. Sopla is when someone uses generally agua florida or something else, and they take some in their mouth, and then they spray someone with a very light mist of that. So a glossary was necessary, but not something that would be worth reading at this stage. I might stop and explain a couple of words as we go along if they're needed. So where I'm going to start is I'm going to start with a very short introduction and then the prologue. Anyway, here's the introduction to Ayahuasca in My Blood, 25 Years of Medicine Dreaming, by yours truly, Peter G. Among the indigenous peoples of the world, there are several plants considered to be master teachers of the human race. Several plants in particular are said to possess the ability to allow a human, on their ingestion, to expand his or her perception and to temporarily access other levels of reality, other levels normally prohibited to all but visionaries, the dying, the very young, and those in moments of extreme stress. Among these is Brugmansia grandiflora, also known as Datura or Toe, the trumpeted flowers of which possess the ability to transport man to worlds beyond imagination, though few are strong enough to use it. Lopophora williamsi is peyote, the ancient cactus of northern Mexico and southern United States. Its cousin is San Pedro, Trichocereus pachanori, the cactus of the Inca, and before them, the people they conquered. Both of those are shapeshifters. Amanita muscaria is a mushroom so potent that Siberian shamans ingested it and then offered their urine, filled with the power of the mushroom, bolstered and balanced by the spirit of a shaman, to the mushroom's devotees to drink. Also among those master teachers are Iboga tamarinth, the West African plant teacher, and ayahuasca, also known as Yahe, Natin, Huasca, and several other names depending on the region, the visionary and curative vine of the Amazon. This is the story of my experience with ayahuasca over a period of 25 years as a student. The first time I experienced a cup of the foul-tasting tea, I had no idea of what it was, how important it was to the people of Arizona, or how my life would change because of it. The first time, it was just something to try. But something extraordinary happened, something that drew me back for a second cup the following year, and then a third. And with each, the vine exposed a little more of her spirit, and with it, I was led deeper and deeper into my consciousness. I had no idea what lay ahead of me would take me beyond the limit of unbearable fear, teach me to heal, help me through the bitter and painful breakup of my family, and then finally put me back together again, just as I was, but somehow completely different. I can say that during those 25 years, I've visited countless worlds and have spent time, often awestruck, with unimaginable entities. I've been tickled by invisible hands from other worlds until I was rendered immobile from joy. I've been attacked by forces I did not know existed and once was given the gift of a moment of absolute unconditional love. It's been an incredible journey of the heart and one I'm thrilled and honored to have been allowed to take. The best part, of course, is that my schooling's just begun. Here's the prologue. I'm going to begin with the supposition that all matter has a life force. By that, I mean all matter is sentient. And all matter dates back from the first moment in time. You and I can trace our lineage back to that moment, just when we were cosmic dust balls, billions of years before becoming slime creatures, and millions of years away from coming out of the primordial soup and clambering up onto land. The same would hold true for a mountain, a rock, a flower. Everything we know and millions of things we don't know trace their existence back to that first moment when matter came into existence. If we were to look at a mountain, for instance, and apply my supposition, imagine what that mountain has gone through since the dawn of time. Imagine what it's experienced. And now imagine what it would be like to be able to communicate with that mountain about those experiences. It's my belief that that's doable. It's my failure that I don't know how to communicate with that being, its will, its personality. But that doesn't mean it's not doable, just that I fail at it. Imagine the same for an ocean, for a fish that's just been bitten by a predator, for a plant. Plants, like everything else, are our co-dwellers in the universe. But humanity has a special relationship with plants. Since the beginning of humanity, plants have provided the bulk of our food, our clothing, our shelter. Some provide us with the loveliest scents, some with extraordinary color. They're the source of our medicines. They go so far as to take the poisonous carbon dioxide that humans exhale and turn it back into life-giving oxygen. That's some relationship. Of course, it may be that plants only invented us to disperse their seeds, so I'm not suggesting they live to cater to us. But they do provide us with much of what we need to exist on this planet. Among the flora of the world as we know it, several plants are not just allies, they're considered master plant teachers. You might extend that to read Master Plant Teachers of Humanity. These plants might also be considered gatekeepers of a sort. These plants are the plants that allow us, we humans, to slow down enough to communicate with the mountains, to speed up enough to communicate with a hummingbird, to visit other realms, past and present and simultaneous, that are here but that we don't ordinarily see or hear with the bandwidths of our senses. When I say realms that are already here, what I mean are other realities that coexist with ours. Imagine a dog whistle. You blow it, you hear nothing. Your cat hears nothing. Birds hear nothing. But a dog will yelp in pain at the sound. So while you couldn't hear it, it was still there. Your hearing just didn't have a broad enough band. Now what I'm suggesting the master plant teachers do is broaden the bands of our senses so that we can see, hear, feel, touch, taste, and sense things we can't under ordinary circumstances. There are several commonly known, and I've just gone through them, though there are undoubtedly others whose existence humanity has either not yet discovered or whose existence is being closely guarded by the peoples who use them. These teachers all have, I believe, will and intent, and have made the choice to be teachers to humanity. They all also have built-in mechanisms that ensure that humanity has to want to ingest them, has to want the knowledge they can impart once they've opened the gates they guard for us. Most of them prevent frivolous and accidental use simply by being physically difficult to ingest. Someone might pick a peyote button and eat it with little difficulty, but to eat 30 or 50 or 100 one would need to talk with the spirit of a plant, it's a very different thing. Similarly, the vile taste of datura or ayahuasca, coupled with the intense purging and often terrifying visionary states they induce, make frivolous or accidental use almost impossible. So while the rose suggests you come to her to bathe in her glorious scent, the master plant teachers want us away from them. You pretty much have to want what they have to offer and be willing to prove it with physical discomfort before they'll share. But once they do, well, once those gates are opened, they will never quite close all the way again. Your broadened band of senses will never quite be able to forget seeing or interacting with the spirits you encountered, the spirits that are sharing you or our space. In other words, the spirits never leave once you made their acquaintance. Of course, if you don't want to learn that ghosts or spirits are everywhere, if you don't want to learn what a flower is thinking or how a tree feels when you prune its branches, you may not want to deal with these medicines. In my own case, some of the teachings have taken years and dozens of sessions to learn. Others have been very simple, but no less profound. Once, years ago, I was in an ayahuasca dream and asked the spirits what I could do to make a better living as a writer. Without hesitation, a spirit said, drink less, write more. That was it, the whole answer. So I drank less, wrote more, and pretty soon was able to support my family and what I earned as a journalist. Realizing that inviting the spirit of a master plant teacher like ayahuasca into your life has lasting repercussions is just one of the frequently overlooked but important aspects of these plants. There are several others as well. Healing is a vital element of all master plant teachers. With ayahuasca, with which we're concerning ourselves, that healing occurs on a physical, emotional, and spiritual level, on spiritual levels, sometimes all in the same session. In northwestern Amazonia, where I spent most of my time with ayahuasca, illness is almost always seen as a symptom of a disorder or disturbance on another plane. Accessing that plane and identifying that disorder will frequently eliminate the symptom. Ayahuasca is one of the methods curanderos, healers, or shaman, use to access those other planes. In that same region, things like mal ojo, the evil eye, celoso, jealousy, and other forms of negative energy, whether produced by a person or by a brujo, a sorcerer paid by someone, they're considered to be very real. That's because of a belief or awareness that intentions, like everything else, have a life force. And that force, good or bad, affects what it touches. At its most basic level, a person living on a river might go to a curandero and say he's got a problem. His problem is that his chickens keep dying and he doesn't understand why. He asks the curandero to drink ayahuasca and see what's causing it. The curandero drinks, contacts the spirit allies, and asks them the cause of the problem. They, in turn, might show him that the neighbor who is angry with the chicken farmer is adding a touch of poison to the chicken's food at night. But the work doesn't end there. A good curandero would look further to see what might have caused such anger in the neighbor and see that the chicken farmer at some earlier time had caused a problem for him. When the curandero comes out of his dream, he has good news and bad news for the farmer. The good news is he's identified the problem. The bad news is that until the chicken farmer acknowledges the initial wrong he did to his neighbor, the poisonings will continue and the chickens will keep dying. One time, a man who kept hurting himself shortly after he sold his plantains went to visit my teacher, Julio, saying that he suspected someone was giving him mal ojo, the evil eye. He asked Julio to drink ayahuasca and see who it was. Julio did, and when he came out of his dream, he told the man that no one was giving him the evil eye. Then why do I keep getting hurt every time I make a little money from selling my plantains, asked the man. Because every time you have money, you get drunk in that little cantina in Enero Herrera. And then when you leave, you trip on the broken step, Julio chuckled. So you can either fix the step or you can stop drinking. On one occasion, just outside of Iquitos, I was present when a man came to a curandero named Juan. The man was beside himself. He was certain that his wife was cheating on him, about to leave him for another man, and he couldn't bear the thought. He wanted to know whether it was true and who the man was. On this occasion, Juan, the man, and I all drank. And all of us saw the same thing. We saw the woman, I only presumed it was his wife, the wife in question, as I didn't know her, speaking with a man on a busy square. When the dream was over, the man was even more distraught. I knew it. She's no good. She's leaving me, he sobbed. Juan asked the man to try to revisit the scene in the ayahuasca dream. He asked the man if he could identify the place. The man did. It was Plaza 28, Plaza 28, one of the city's main plazas and not far from the center of town. Juan then asked the man to try to calm down enough to see the man more clearly in the vision. This time the man grew even more distraught. He's a priest. She's cheating with a priest. Juan laughed. No, she's not cheating. Did you hear what they were talking about? The man said he hadn't. She was telling him that you're so jealous that you always think she's cheating. And then you get drunk and you hit her. And now, even though she still loves you, she can't take your jealousy and the beatings anymore. So she's talking with the priest about getting a divorce. The man started to deny it, then began to sob and admitted that what Juan said was true. He kept beating her because he thought she was so beautiful that everyone wanted her, and he didn't want her to leave him. These healings are typical of the work curandero does with people he treats. But ayahuasca healing is not limited to those sorts of things. In sessions with Don Julio, I've had some guests of mine, Europeans and people from the States, clear up physical ailments, emotional ailments, solve midlife crisis. One unusual type of healing that's common with ayahuasca deals with soul loss, a condition most Westerners have never even heard of, and if they have, it's not something they would believe is real. Soul loss is a condition in which a person's soul, a life force, flees the body, generally during a traumatic experience, leaving the body nearly lifeless. If the life force is not reunited with the body quickly, the person will frequently die, and if he or she doesn't die, will be little more than a vegetable. Several years ago, an old indigenous Matsez woman who lived not far from Julio was washing her clothes in her canoe on the river. She looked into the water and saw her recently deceased husband. He was calling her to join him. Then she saw her own grave next to his. This we learned later. What those who were there saw was a woman suddenly lurch forward and fall from the canoe, screaming. She climbed onto the riverbank and began racing headlong through tall grass towards the village she lived in. In her panic, she stumbled on a fallen tree trunk hidden in the grass and fell, hitting her head. Her nephews brought her to Julio, and I happened to be there. They had to carry her from the canoe. Her breathing was very shallow. Her eyes were rolled back in her head. She did not respond to touch. Julio had her laid down on a hut floor and began to treat her. He chanted, cleansed her with smoke and agua florida, the ubiquitous holy water of northwestern Amazonia, and then went into a trance that lasted perhaps an hour. During the trance, he was as lifeless as she, except for moments of agitation, when his fists would clench and his shoulders shudder, and he would speak unintelligibly. He began to sweat profusely. When he came out of the trance, his clothes were soaked through, and he told the Matsez men to bring her back the next day at the same time. She left as lifelessly as she arrived, and she arrived the next day as lifelessly as she left. The second day's treatment was much like the first, except that Julio forced a little bit of a plant decoction that he had his son Jairo make into the woman's mouth. And this time, when Julio was in his trance and would tense up, the woman began to tense up as well. She was still unconscious, but moaned perceptibly and gritted her jaw. When he was finished, he told her nephews to bring her back to finish her treatments the next day at the same time. Once she had gone, Julio related that he'd seen the woman see her husband in the river calling to her, that she'd seen her grave. It was such a shock that her soul fled, leading her to fall from the canoe, then race mindlessly until she'd physically fallen. He thought she'd be better the next day. During the third treatment, when Julio began to chant, the woman began to move. She moaned, clenched her jaw, and folded her hands into fists. She began to move her torso. Within an hour, she opened her eyes, and there was recognition in them. Julio chanted and cleansed the woman. She was given a little bit more of the plant medicine. This time, she tried to object to it, and her movements began to take on a solidity. An hour later, and she was angrily asking Julio what he was doing and why the heck she was there at his house. Another hour, and she could be helped back to her feet, and with assistance, walked back to the canoe. She'd gotten her soul back. The next day, she returned, still weak, and Julio asked what happened to cause her soul to flee. She told the same story Julio had told 2 days earlier. Ayahuasca is frequently called la purga, the purge, because users tend to physically purge themselves. Generally, within 20 to 40 minutes of drinking ayahuasca, the user will be overcome with an impossible-to-resist urge to vomit that's sometimes accompanied by a similarly uncontrollable urge to excrete. A lot of people who drink the medicine hate this part of it, but the purge is one of the most effective healing elements of ayahuasca, touching on the physical, emotional, and spiritual levels at the same time. In northwest Amazonia, among the most typical illnesses are gastrointestinal problems. The reasons for that out on the river include a lack of refrigeration, sun-drying fish that later gets wet and then is dried again, a perfect setup for parasites, game that often carries parasites that, if not cooked well enough, can be transmitted to humans. In the city, meat and fish in the markets in Iquitos will often be salted, but otherwise uncooked and could go unrefrigerated in the tropical heat and humidity for weeks until it's sold. Ayahuasca cleans out those parasites better than any other medicine available in the region. But for those suffering emotional and spiritual issues, La Purga is equally effective. Normally, it's recommended that a person drinking ayahuasca fast for at least several hours and often for a full day before drinking. That ensures an empty stomach, but it won't diminish the purging effects. The difference in the purge on an empty stomach, however, is that instead of vomiting lunch, the participant will have a chance to vomit some of the bile of their lives, things they carry around and which clutter up their mental and spiritual arenas uselessly. Most of us don't even realize what we're carrying. None of us can remember the first time we were scolded by what was, until then, the loving voice of our mother or father, but it certainly left a scar. Few of us remember all of the hearts we broke or the lies we told breaking them. Most of us do remember those who broke our hearts and every little lie that was told doing it. That's emotional junk, and we're better off tossing it. Guilt for something we can't fix? Get rid of it. ayahuasca spirit reaches down to the depths of your soul and roots around for those things and brings them to the surface in the frightening moments of ego dissolution, in a wretched reliving of them, and then allows you to eliminate them. It's not like vomiting at all. It's as if great chunks of physical matter are explosively hurled from the bottom of your bowels, a vomiting that often sounds like a waterfall in reverse, the water rushing up the rocks and violently cascading from your mouth. My guests in the jungle swear they vomited heaps. In truth, they rarely vomit more than the few ounces of ayahuasca they drank, as they have nothing physical in their stomachs to eliminate. Another element of our healing that's frequently overlooked must be touched on. Curanderos in both the Amazon and elsewhere have often have to suck illnesses, physical, emotional, spiritual, from their patients. But illnesses, like all other matter, are sentient and have the same will to live as other things. The person who explained that to me originally was Bertha Grove, a medicine woman from the Southern Ute tribe outside of Durango, Colorado. She was elderly but powerful. I had attended several all-night coyote ceremonies with the Utes, during which Bertha was always present. It had probably taken a year to get permission to attend the first. After several, I asked permission to bring my sister, an acupuncturist. Bertha said okay, and Pat joined me. The ceremony that evening was being held for a youngster who was quite ill. At one point during the ceremony, Bertha stood, took the boy, and began to suck the top of his head. In a few minutes, she stopped and briefly stepped outside the teepee. In the morning, outside the teepee, Bertha called to my sister and I. "You both saw what I did in there, didn't you?" she asked. We said we had. "I sucked that boy's sickness out. But I don't know if you understand that that sickness wants to live. It's just as willful as you or me. And now if I suck that sickness out and spit it out, it's going to be lying on the ground just waiting for someone to step on it. And then that person's going to get sick. They might not get the same sickness the boy had, because sickness can change its shape and affect different people different ways. But it will always be sickness or something bad. So when we Indians suck out a sickness, we don't swallow it. We spit it out. We always wrap it up in something. Not that you can see. Something like invisible gauze. And we send it off somewhere to a place where it will never be allowed to land on someone else and make them sick. I send mine to a far-off planet that's very cold and barren. Other healers send theirs to their own places. Now the reason I'm telling you this," she said to my sister, "is that last night I saw you. I saw that you're an excellent healer, but you have a problem. You're taking sickness out of people and you don't know how to get rid of it, so it's just staying on you. You're covered in a lot of sicknesses and you've got to stop, because even though you're strong, you're going to get real sick real soon if you don't get rid of all that." 6 months later, my sister did get sick. She got a host of illnesses that were apparently unrelated, but which would leave her crippled and in pain for the next 20 years. Another point I think needs making, as it frequently comes up in conversations related to the use of ayahuasca, San Pedro, peyote, and probably all of the master plant teachers, is the question of the value of a curandero. The question that arises is whether or not a curandero, in the case of ayahuasca or San Pedro, or a roadman, in the case of peyote, is necessary. The answer, I think, is that they're not necessary. The plants will teach you something, whether there's a curandero there or not. But I think the work of a good curandero can add a whole dimension to the experience. On a physical level, the curandero is a master preparer of the ayahuasca. He must be compared to a chef rather than a cook. More than that, however, his interaction with the spirit of the plants he's working with are what's of great value. The plants must give up their chemicals to whoever puts them in a pot and boils them. But the curandero, through his relationship with the sentient side of the plant, can encourage those plants to give up more than their chemical components, to give up their spirit. This cannot be dismissed. Curanderos have generally spent years becoming intimate with the spirit of the plants they work with. Moreover, the curandero might have several plant allies, and depending on the needs of those drinking on a given day, might have a variety of admixture plants you can add to the basic recipe. Each of those plants bring their individual spirits and personalities to the ceremony the curandero is running. And running the ceremony is really what a curandero does. It might look to an outsider as if he or she is just sitting on a stool, chanting and shaking a rattle leaf bundle. But he's doing much more than that. He's seeing what each person is dreaming. His ícaros, his songs, are sending some further out into their dreams and pulling others back to earth at the same time. The curandero is healing everyone simultaneously as well, even those that don't know they need it. He's asking his plant spirit allies to work with everyone, and his allies respond. Until you've experienced it, it's a difficult thing to believe. One former guest explained it this way just hours after his first ayahuasca experience. The guest was named Lynn, and he was one of two males among my six guests. He was sitting there on the hut floor, he said, and not having much reaction to the medicine at all. At one point in the ceremony, he said, I mentally called out to Julio to just show me something, anything, that would indicate I hadn't just taken this very expensive trip and come all the way to Peru for nothing. I had my eyes open while I was thinking that, Lynn said, and as soon as I did, Julio suddenly stood and grew to about 14 feet tall, and his chakras began spinning with the most fantastic lights, shooting colors all over the space and me. And then he very clearly said, in English, now can I go back to the work I was doing on the women? In that moment, Lynn said, I understood something fantastic happens out in that realm, a realm that I wasn't even certain existed until that point in time.